This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. A gun is a thing. It's an inanimate object, mass-produced. It's a commodity. It's been given special status, though, in our nation with a unique acknowledgement in the Second Amendment in our Constitution. The gun is also a symbol. To some, it's a symbol of freedom, tradition, power. To others, it's a symbol of death, fear, and oppression. America is divided along the firing line, but is there room to find common ground for common sense gun reform? What are the areas that most Americans can agree on when we talk about doing something about guns? Can we at least agree that something, what's happening right now with all these horrible mass shootings, that we need to stop shouting and start talking about guns in America? Call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We want to hear from everybody. 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at @tprsource. With me in the studio is Al Kaufman, professor of law at St. Mary's School of Law. David Yamani is a sociology professor at Wake Forest University and author of The Sociology of U.S. Gun Culture. Also, we're joined by Jocelyn Kelly. She is Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
So, Jocelyn, let's start off with your Pew Research studies that y'all have done. And it seems like the title of your study is Gun Policy Remains Divisive, but several proposals still draw bipartisan support. So it seems like you're finding that there is common ground. Is that right?
There certainly are areas of common ground. So we've long asked a series of different policies looking at public opinion. So we have trends not just from today, but also from about a year and a half ago on some of these policies. And there's broad support for preventing people with mental illnesses from purchasing guns, for barring gun purchases by people on federal no-fly or watch lists, and for background checks for private sales and gun shows. So for all of those, there's support across the board from the public. More than 8 in 10 support this, and 8 in 10 or more roughly among both Republicans and Democrats say this too. So there are some areas where there's a lot of agreement.
So you say there's one area that people can agree on is trying to keep guns out of the hands of people who are dealing with mental illness. We have a caller along those lines, so let's go to that. The number is 210-614-8980. And Walter, Walter, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad that the conversation's about sensible gun control because, I mean, in Texas, I mean, this is a gun culture state. And you know, for most people, a universal background check would probably be suffice as far as, you know, it would be pretty much non-invasive. I mean, a lot of people that do have guns don't complain about having to, you know, pay a fee and take classrooms for concealed weapons courses. So just having to take a background check, universal background check, and waiting, you know, 2 or 3 days for the results doesn't seem like it's that much to ask. And if you need a gun sooner than that, then there might be other issues that you might need law enforcement to call on or possibly a physician. So the 2 or 3 day wait period does not seem that far out. But when it comes for people with mental illness, that's something that there's really not enough obstacles you can put in the way to try to keep it out of their hands. I mean, it's going to take an all of the above approach from universal background checks to red flag laws, everything. I mean, it's kind of like a child. You can't, if you're trying to protect one from getting into things, you can't just put up a baby gate and say, you know, we're taking care of. I mean, you got to do more. You got to pick up things off the floor. Block off electrical outlets, stuff like that. And it goes with mental illness. I mean, they really have the mentality when they're off their meds, they got the mentality of a 2-year-old, but yet they've got the liberties and resources and independence of an adult.
Got it. Walter, thank you for the call. You bring up a lot of great points. But to the issue of mental illness with and gun rights, back to Jocelyn on that, in your Pew Research Center, when you start talking about mental illness, that can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. Do you dive into that in your research?
We haven't in the survey, and I think that's certainly something that comes up in policy discussions. But you know, there are areas that are less about public opinion than about practical policy questions for legislators and so on.
Right. So that's where the detail. That's where the devil is. It's in those details. So David Yamani is a sociology professor at Wake Forest University. He's author of The Sociology of U.S. Gun Culture. And so what is our sociology? I mean, it seems we have gun culture. I mean, it seems like it's always been part of us, right?
Yeah, I think that it's important to understand in any kind of discussion of guns in the United States that this is something that has been a part of the country from its founding, although it hasn't been the same since its founding. And so, you know, my take on contemporary gun culture recognizes the many different subcultures we have, including hunting and recreational target shooting, but also seeing that the core of American gun culture has really shifted much more towards armed self-defense, which has always been a part of American history, but it's really at the center of American gun culture today. And to try to figure out the implications of that is the purpose of my work.
So how does studying the sociology of gun culture, how people see guns, how we incorporate guns into our lives, who owns guns, who's most likely to own a gun, how guns are used in America, how they're viewed in America, the sociology of it, how does that help us figure out what to do about all of these guns and trying to find common sense solutions?
Well, so that's an interesting point because, you know, I tell people that I'm studying gun culture, and what a lot of people hear me saying is that I'm studying gun violence or gun control. And I think that's one of the problems that we have in talking about guns in America today, which is that for some people, the only association that they have with guns is in terms of violence or negative outcomes. And for another large group of Americans, the only associations they have with guns are positive things, self-defense, time with family, recreation. And so I don't come about my work saying, if I can understand gun culture, I'll have solutions to gun violence, because those are really two separate issues in certain ways.
But it does seem like when you give someone a gun, I mean, I love shooting. It does, there's a certain enjoyment that comes from that. People are really drawn to having a gun. Is there some sort of explanation for that?
Well, I think you touched on some of them right there, is that shooting a gun is fun in the same way that, you know, throwing a dart can be fun, or bowling, or any sort of thing that takes a lot of precision and skill. But, you know, my work really does focus on this movement towards self-defense. And the notion that, you know, if people need to have firearms to defend themselves, and that, you know, for some people becomes a concern. They don't feel comfortable having people walking around or in public with firearms for self-defense. But by and large, these, you know, people who are involved in defensive firearms gun culture are sort of among your most law-abiding citizens. They tend not to have problems.
So maybe we should develop more precise language in talking about these issues. Maybe that's part of the solution. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We've got callers on the board. We want to hear from Al Coffin from St. Mary's School of Law. The number is 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a gun show, different kind of gun show, not the kind where you can go and you can purchase firearms, but we want to talk about firearms. How are they a thing in the United States? The Second Amendment enshrines them in our government. Why did that happen, and how has that changed over the years? And is this something that can be modified and matured and dealt with as things change, as circumstances change in the country? With us now, Al Coffman, professor at St. Mary's School of Law. And Al, welcome back to The Source. How is it that we have a Second Amendment?
Well, of course, the Second Amendment was part of the Bill of Rights in 1791. But the Second Amendment had been interpreted by the courts just to mean that states had the right to have militias and that they could arm their state militias. It had never been interpreted to mean there's any personal right to carry a gun until 2008. So it was a brand new decision, a brand new discovered right, 5-4 decision. That was Heller.
The Heller decision, that was District of Columbia v. Heller. And it was Heller was a guy who wanted to own a gun, and he lived in Washington, D.C., but he had to keep his gun in Maryland in order to go shoot with it. And he was able to successfully, you know, petition and go to the Supreme Court. People are kind of astonished that it was as recent as 2008 that this was something that was codified.
Well, it was, and I think to some extent it just came about as a development in the Supreme Court in terms of the justices' different positions. But also, the District of Columbia had an extremely limiting law. It said that you could not even have a handgun in your home that was operable. If you had a handgun, you had to have a lock on it, or you had to have the ammunition separately.
And this is at a time when Washington, D.C. was very dangerous, and even the basketball team was called the Bullets.
Well, that's right. But the District of Columbia, I think, went so far that they actually enabled people who wanted to find the Second Amendment right, because their bill was so strong. You couldn't have an operable rifle or gun in your home. So in the Supreme Court, in a very limiting decision, it discovered this right, but it said that it only applies to law-abiding citizens to use arms in defense of hearth and home. So it was limited to law-abiding citizens. It was only for self-defense. It was only for self-defense of the home and the hearth. And the Supreme Court, although they did discover this right, put significant limitations on it.
But people do point to the Second Amendment. Even originalists will say, you know, they will dispute your analysis that this was something that was designed just for a well-regulated militia.
Well, indeed, the Supreme Court found against me on that. They found that it was much more. It did have a personal right. What I want to make clear is, though, that does not mean that there can be no reasonable limits on guns, reasonable limits on people who can buy guns, no reasonable limits on where you can bring guns. All of that, the Supreme Court saw as problems, and they specifically said, our decision does not limit the control of having felons or persons who misdemeanors of domestic abuse getting guns. It doesn't control having weapons that were never foreseen in the time of the passage of the amendment. It doesn't control limiting whether guns can be in schools and hospitals, churches, and courthouses.
But we should also look at that issue that, you know, the Supreme Court makes a decision and things change. The Second Amendment is something that is not enshrined in gospel. This is something that is adjusted, will adjust over time.
And indeed, in every area of constitutional law, there's some decisions and they develop over time. It's interesting, if you look at what the other courts have done after Heller, they have completely supported controlling guns. They've said it's okay for states to have laws saying felons cannot have guns. It's okay for states to have laws that misdemeanor domestic violations people cannot have guns. It's okay to control sawed-off shotguns. It's okay to control assault weapons with the ability to create mass murder. So all of these things are specifically allowed by the courts. So since the Heller decision, many courts have looked at it and said it is a very limiting right. It just talks about your rights to self-defense of the home and the hearth. It doesn't allow a general, broad right to any gun at any time.
Back to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Natasha. Natasha, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to ask y'all take on the specific phrase that guns rights are women's rights, and like what role that really plays in the empowerment of women. Because I know a lot of women that say they feel safer with a gun and just in their ability to defend themselves less than they would be without one.
Natasha, thank you for that. So Jocelyn Kelly over at the Pew Research Center, can you respond to that?
Well, I guess what I would say is one of the questions we do ask is a question that if more
Americans owned guns, would there be more crime, no difference, less crime? That certainly gun owners have a feeling that there would be less crime if more Americans owned guns. 53% say that, and 34% say there'd be no difference. Those who don't own guns feel differently. So I think this is a case, as so much of this conversation is, where there are really very different views. People have very different views about whether guns make them feel safer or make them feel less safe. So I don't want to say, I think that there are certainly women that feel the way that the caller mentioned. I think that there are a sizable share of women who feel quite differently about that too. And these views differ, as I mentioned earlier. There are wide partisan differences, both about gun policies, but also just about a sense of you know, what the effect of guns in society is. And some of that is also attributable to, you know, regional differences. As we discussed earlier, there are what guns are feel like in urban areas are different than for hunters and sportsmen and so on. And so when we talk about guns and gun policy in the U.S., we're talking about a very diverse country in a lot, you know, in a lot of different ways. And yet we're talking about policies that might apply across the country.
David Yamani, sociology professor, can you talk about women and guns? Is that something you look at? And apparently we lost that call. And so, but the issue though is that if you own a gun, statistics tell us you're less likely to, you're not really use it to fend off an aggressor, someone who's trying to invade you, but always you're more likely to have it turned against you or actually use it against someone that you know or love. And so the impressions that people have about guns is not necessarily a reflection of what actually happens. There's a lot of, you know, in our gun culture, discussions about, you know, what guns are and what and how they are used, but how rooted is that in reality? Let's go to another caller. Here's Kenneth. And Kenneth, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Outstanding. You segued right into what I wanted to talk about. You always do a great job, but I'll take my hats off the air and thank you for taking my call. It's real simple. To me, it seems that the gun culture doesn't seem to realize when you use a weapon, it's a weapon of last resort, as you mentioned. 9 times out of 10, I see somebody, the dog goes on your yard, you get your gun to settle an argument. Guy cuts you off on the expressway, you wave your weapon at him. And that's not what that's for. The same way you just don't drive a car in Germany, I feel that there should be a more stringent type of, I could say, vetting process and teaching someone how to use a firearm properly. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenneth. So Al Kaufman, professor of St. Mary's School of Law, people who use a gun improperly, how vulnerable are they to being brought into the judicial system?
Not very likely, but of course, if you assault someone by pulling out a gun and aiming it at them without reason, you can be charged with assault, and that would probably hold. But that doesn't happen very often. The main concern is that the more guns there are, the more people that have them, especially people who haven't been carefully vetted to make sure that they're mentally capable of having guns, the more likely you are to have incidents of mass shootings and inadvertent murders.
All right. So David Yamani joins us. He's the sociology professor. And we were talking about women and guns and the reality of people have the way people think that a gun will be used or should be used versus how it actually is implemented in our daily lives. You know, so is there a disconnect between what we see and what we hear about guns and what's actually going on with guns?
Well, I wanted to mention just in terms of the women and guns that, of course, there's been a historical association of gun ownership with men and particularly white men and maybe politically conservative white men from the South. But one of the things I see in gun culture 2.0 is a diversification of gun ownership. And so you do see more women getting into firearms ownership almost exclusively for self-defense. So if you look at gun owners who only own a handgun, which is your prototypical defensive handgun owner, you see a higher proportion of women in that group. And also, if you look at the number of women who are getting Texas concealed handgun licenses, for example, those numbers have been going up dramatically over the last several years. So the caller's point that there are a substantial minority of women who are looking to firearms for self-defense seems to be borne out, in fact. Now, in terms of responsible ownership, you know, there's no law that requires anybody who owns a gun to be responsible. And so this is becomes more an issue of culture and of socializing people into the proper use of firearms. And you do see, you know, every now and then a concealed carrier doing something stupid with their gun. But if you think about the 16.5 million people who've got concealed handgun permits in the United States, if a lot of those people were doing irresponsible things with their guns, we would see much more news coverage of the negative outcomes. It's just not something that happens very often.
Well, I don't know about that, because a lot of times things happen with guns and it doesn't really necessarily get covered by the news.
I think if someone who is legally carrying a concealed weapon does something illegal with their gun, that it's probably going to be picked up in the news at some level. I mean, I find, you know, road rage incidents covered quite a bit, people pulling their handgun inappropriately when they're shopping and these sorts of things. So, I mean, not to say that the news covers every story, but I think there is a lot of interest and concern in people who are legally carrying concealed. And so if they do stupid things, it oftentimes does come up in the news.
Jocelyn, in your Pew study, you say that a majority of Americans say gun laws should be stricter. How much so?
So overall, 57% of Americans say that overall gun laws should be stricter than they are today, while 11% say they should be less strict. Again, there are these divisions between gun owners and non-gun owners. So only 13% of Republican gun owners say they should be more strict. By contrast, 64% of Democratic gun owners say they should be more strict. So there's a big partisan divide, and there's also a divide between gun owners and non-gun owners within both of the parties. But that said, overall, you do see that there's an overall sentiment among Americans that they should be stricter.
And but when we start trying to have this discussion, frequently there's some sort of drop-off. Frequently, you know, it's easy to talk about these in the abstract, but once they go to the polling slots, do you think that these types of numbers will hold?
Well, I think we've seen in past years these debates around gun policies really do, they seem to change as they approach Washington, right, as they approach as Congress gets into the nitty-gritty. The last time we saw a debate in Washington around gun policies, we actually saw a lot of support for the components of some of the proposed legislation, but less support for the legislation overall. And we see that not just with respect to guns. It's not uncommon to see that. But I think some of it is, you know, a skepticism of federal regulation overall. But also, as you mentioned before, the details really matter to a lot of people. What are we talking about when we talk about background checks or, you know, one of the a common proposal is a federal database, which is supported by a majority of both Republicans and Democrats, though far more Democrats than Republicans support that. But what does that look like in actuality? And that's when I think you tend to find some more resistance.
And when you tell many people that there's a need for a database of gun ownership in America, they kind of astonished that we don't actually have one. We'll talk more about that when we come back. I want to thank Jocelyn Kiley for joining us. She's the Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center. We have a copy of the report on our website at tpr.org. We're going to continue our discussion about America's gun culture, looking for common ground for common sense gun reform. What would that look like? What can Americans agree on as we talk about guns? Stay tuned. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. There's been an unfortunate pattern of gun violence and mass shootings here in America, and they're growing in frequency. There just last week, 12 people were killed at a country western-themed bar in California. That was a story for maybe 2 days, and then it fell off. These terrible things have become so common in America that can barely hold our attention. Can common ground be found moving towards some sort of common sense gun policy? We're talking with experts and researchers today, and we invite you into the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. We're now bringing in Abigail Abrams. She is the co-author of the Time magazine piece, Guns Have Divided America. Here's what happened when 245 people tried to meet in the middle. Abigail, welcome to The Source.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So what happens when you get 245 people to meet in the middle?
Well, what we saw in our project at Time is that a lot of these people, the 245 that we brought into this project, really had never talked about this topic with folks who did not hold the same views as them or with the media at all before. And I think the biggest takeaway for us was really that people did want similar goals across the board. So whether they were coming at things as gun owners or coming at things from the gun control side, everyone talked about, you know, wanting safety, wanting to reduce violence, wanting to make sure that people who do have mental health problems or are dangerous don't have access to guns. It was really about, obviously, the different ways that they got there.
So the 245 people, were they inclusive of NRA members, maybe someone who's lost someone in a mass shooting? Was it the spectrum?
Absolutely. So we went into the project really trying to represent the full complexity of America's gun debate. And so we searched for people we anchored the project in three different cities. We went to St. Louis, Missouri, to Dallas, Texas, and to Washington, D.C. And we had NRA members. We had family members who had lost people to gun violence. We had, you know, police officers in different cities. We had politicians, lobbyists, kind of everybody from all different perspectives, competitive shooters, teachers, trauma surgeons, everyone.
And it's one thing to try to have a conversation with these individuals, and when we try to come up with political solutions, we don't have to please everyone. We just have to please enough people in order to come up with some sort of equilibrium in society, I guess. How many people are we willing to say of the 245 were just like, I'm out. This is not working for me.
Right. I mean, certainly not everyone is going to agree, but I think what we found were that a lot of people were really willing to listen to each other, and some people had never really considered the details of the points of view from folks coming at the conversation from a different side from their own. And so people really, we saw them interact as they were waiting to get their photos taken, as we were interviewing them, people who were competitive shooters on a maybe high school team, you know, ended up being in the waiting room with folks who worked in a gun violence de-escalation center, and student activists who went to a March for Our Lives protest were there with students who experienced kind of community violence. And so a lot of them did actually talk to each other and were really open to at least understanding where different people were coming from.
So then why the division? If it's this easy for us to talk to each other in your environment that you put together, why doesn't this happen on a broader scale?
I think a lot of it is that, I mean, it's easy to talk to someone face-to-face when you're seeing them, you're hearing their personal story, you understand that this person has experienced violence in their life and they have a reason behind their point of view. It's harder to do that when we're on social media, when we're at a national scale, and when people are talking about policy suggestions that don't necessarily align with, you know, their point of view. When we get to the national scale, it's harder to, you know, understand someone's personal story.
Well, it also seems like there are people who traffic in misinformation, and as soon as someone starts talking about trying to put in commonplace gun reforms, they're going to start talking about they're coming to take my guns away. There's a reactionary element to some of this.
Definitely. I mean, I think a lot of gun owners are often concerned that, you know, the way that either media organizations talk about gun legislation or certain politicians talk about it, they feel that people don't necessarily understand where they're coming from, and so they have concerns about the national debate, and then folks on the other side feel like people don't take their, you know, concerns about the violence seriously. I think that a lot of the misinformation comes from people, you know, not reading sources beyond their little bubble, and this kind of goes to our larger political debate that people don't necessarily seek out information that doesn't already confirm their, you know, beliefs.
Okay. Another caller, 210-614-8980 to join our conversation as we talk about American gun culture, looking for common ground, for common sense. Sister Elizabeth joins us. And Sister Elizabeth, welcome to The Source again.
Thanks, David. Another great show. And it's so wonderful to bring all these different perspectives into this because they really are intertwined. My own point is that when we start talking about laws and political implications of gun control, we are at the last possible stop, as you have pointed out. But I'm wondering why we would not begin with teaching people conflict resolution skills as a regular subject in school, teaching them how to control their emotions, teaching them the value of life, etc. Instead, our children have modeled for them from the adult world that the first way that you resolve a difference is to grab a gun. If we look at our TV shows, if we look at our games that they play, this is automatically training them to pick up a weapon and use it without ever talking to the person they don't like.
All right, Sister, thank you for that. And Abigail Abrams, before I lose you, I know I only have you for 10 minutes. Any reaction to what Sister Elizabeth has to say?
I think that's a really important point. A lot of the people that we talked to in our project talked about the social element of this, too. We had the urban specialist group that's based in Dallas, and we had a community group based in St. Louis as well that works on kind of addressing the social aspects behind where gun violence comes from. And especially in communities that do often see this kind of violence, there's a big focus on that at the local level.
Abigail Abrams, the co-author of the Time magazine piece, Guns Have Divided America. Here's what happens when 245 people try to meet in the middle. It was great to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Al Kaufman, professor of St. Mary's School of Law. For 200 years in America, it seemed like the Second Amendment was as relevant as the Third Amendment, which was the one about quartering soldiers in your house. It really wasn't talked about.
You're right. There had been a few opinions in the 20th century about it, and they all held that it didn't apply to give an individual a right to buy a certain gun or to stop the state from having laws preventing the sale of certain types of guns. And in terms of these, the people who've been on your panel so far, Ms. Kiley and Ms. Abrams, the important point for me is that the cases don't prevent governments from passing laws in any of these areas. The cases don't prevent governments from passing laws requiring much more extensive registration, longer waits before you buy guns, prohibiting the sale or use of certain types of guns. All that is within the powers of states and local governments. So it's important to me that as we discuss this, we don't see it as an issue of people who are for, people who are against the Second Amendment. The fact is the Second Amendment provides protection just for using your gun in your home, your handgun in your home. That's where it is. It's not talking about people walking around with AR-15 semi-automatic or automatic machine guns, Uzis. Those are not protected by the Second Amendment.
Well, people are still buying them.
People are still buying them, but I think
Going into nightclubs,
going
shooting
into nightclubs,
people, going into churches,
going
shooting
into
people.
Nightclubs, temples, churches, schools. You're right. And I think if anything, the movement has to be toward requiring our public officials to be stronger in passing more limitations on the buying and use of guns. That's the only way to get at these mass shootings and to get at a gigantic explosion of personal gun violence.
Back to the phones with Will, 210-614-8980. And Will, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I think if we could have an honest discussion in this country, then we would be okay. But when we start talking about gun violence, well, they keep trying to say the gun is doing all this, and it's not. It's a mental health issue. Guns are not the problem. It's the people that are getting them that's the problem. But to take the guns away from law-abiding citizens is not the answer. And, yeah.
All right. Well, okay. Let's go over to our sociologist, David Yamani. He's from Wake Forest University. And your reaction to Will's comment?
Well, I mean, I think that that's the getting at some of the issue in terms of the kind of language that we use. And sometimes if we use certain language, we're going to be alienating people either intentionally or unintentionally. So, I mean, we began by talking about mental illness and that having so many different meanings to different people. So just saying mental illness in itself doesn't really get us that far, because everyone from Andrew Cuomo to Wayne LaPierre can point a finger at mental illness and say that's the problem. And in fact, if you find an issue on which Andrew Cuomo and Wayne LaPierre agree, you might actually want to be skeptical about what exactly they're agreeing about. So, you know, the precision of the language that we use, I think, matters. You know, we just a few minutes ago conflated semi-automatic versus automatic weapons. Average citizens cannot legally own automatic weapons in the United States, at least not very easily. So to talk about the ability to regulate automatic weapons alongside the regulation of semi-automatic weapons, which is the vast majority of weapons that are owned, doesn't help bring the discussion along. So I think both sides have to be attuned to the using language that is somewhat more precise.
All right, so we're going to take a break here. We'll be back in 1 minute talking about American gun culture, looking for common ground and common sense. 210-614-8980. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about American gun culture today. We invite you into the conversation, 210-614-8980. Philip has called in, and Philip, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
I was just going to bring up a topic I don't think it's been brought up yet. I don't think guns are the issue. I kind of agree with Will on that, and the reason I say that is because back in the 1900s-ish, you know, like a 100 years ago maybe, there were 3 or 4 mass shootings a year max, like in a bad year. And now not much has changed, and that there's hundreds of mass shootings a year.
And so, Philip, do you have a source on that?
I don't have a source. I'm just speaking from, you know, knowledge. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have any kind of source at all. I'm just saying I don't remember hearing about a lot of mass shootings back in the old days, and nowadays there's 309, I believe, this year.
All right, Philip, thank you for the call. So I've been looking at a lot of history lately, going through old newspapers, and I find that actually I could challenge that by saying that actually mass shootings did happen with quite frequent at the time. There was a lot of mental illness and a lot of availability of arms. We had a lot of people slaughtering their own families out in the Old West. It's just something that, you know, I think that as we try to gain our knowledge about where we are in comparison to the past based upon mythology, we really need a solid examination of the facts. So, David Yamani, you are a sociology professor from Wake Forest University. Can you talk about that?
Well, I mean, we live in the most mass-mediated age in human history. And so if there has been an uptick in mass shootings, or probably more likely in the casualty counts in mass shootings in recent years, it's been far exceeded by the media coverage of those events and the immediacy with which we learn about these things. So as you say, that, you know, mass murder in the United States with guns and bombs and other tools, it's happened throughout American history. We just have a different way of engaging with those events today, which makes it seem much more immediate and much worse, much, you know, in the way that we experienced war differently when media were embedded with troops in Vietnam. It just brought war, which is as old as humankind, home in a different sort of way.
Al Kaufman?
I guess a few comments to some of the callers. The thing about, you know, guns don't kill people, people do, that might be right, except that the opponents of any sort of gun control are against any sort of controls on who may buy a gun. there any sort of registration. So they're even against preventing people with mental illnesses, no matter how you define them, from buying guns. Also, it's one thing when a person with mental illness has a knife. It's another thing when they have either an automatic, and I will say semi-automatic gun that's been modified for mass murder, such as what happened in Las Vegas and what happened in these schools and churches and temples. So those are different things. As far as the semi-automatic versus automatic, the AR-15 is often talked about. The AR-15 is developed after a military gun and is advertised as giving you the power of the military to control yourself in terms of many people attacking you. And it's built so that you can put a magazine of 30 to 100 shells in it. And even if it's semi-automatic, you can shoot off 30 to 100 shells in 5 seconds instead of 2 seconds as in a machine gun. So all of these things fit together, but if we're going to be precise, we all need to be precise. My point again is that the Constitution doesn't prevent counties, cities, and the federal government from issuing much more legislation in this area, and it needs to be done.
Back to the calls. Moses is on the line. And Moses, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. It's a timely conversation, unfortunately, but as a physician, I have friends that are in both sides of the spectrum. I think that this should be also seen as a healthcare crisis, and most of the times when we approach healthcare crisis in a scientific and studious way, we've been able to deal with epidemics like HIV, Ebola, and all of those things. But this has been treated as the NRA does not allow funds to go to research. And we should be able to discern how we can use these tools, which is our other tools, and who people we should not have. And I clearly don't think that a weapon that can kill a large number of humans in 5 seconds has any use in civil society.
All right, Moses, thank you for the call. I'm going to Steve. And Steve, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, I've got a couple points to make. One, if you want to stop mass shootings at schools, why don't you harden the infrastructure around the schools? Put up metal detectors, put up fences, put up gates. People aren't allowed to go in there. You don't need to be in there. Number two, I think you can probably correlate a lot of the gun violence in this country straight back to video games. There's no place. Why do we need Grand Theft Auto and stupid games like that to promote criminality? And third, if the police would crack down on and increase the laws on stolen guns and people carrying guns when they shouldn't be, on felons and whatnot, you'd cut out a lot of this. But regulating guns is not the answer. You're not going to take my guns away.
No one wants to take your guns away, Steve. So David Yamani, sociology professor at Wake Forest University, is the United States the only country in the world that has video games?
No, I mean, unfortunately, there's no empirical evidence that the use of these kind of video games is correlated with gun violence. And if it were, given the hundreds of millions of people who play these video games, I think, you know, there would be much more violence. So, but yeah, I think that one of the things to recognize is that there is a sense that, and the professor of law is exactly correct, that you can limit the ownership of certain types of firearms. That hasn't been determined to be unconstitutional. So you can ban AR style rifles, you can limit magazine capacities. So that's strictly an issue of political will. But you know, there are divisions. So, you know, if it's a red state or a red locality, that's not going to happen. If it's sure. blue, then it's much more likely to happen. So the issue is, how do you get that as you know, as we come right. closer to Washington?
Well, let me ask you about, you know, our caller's tone. He seemed very upset, and he said, "You're not going to take my guns away." And I imagine this person is probably extremely responsible and is not going to do anything that would put anyone in harm, and there would be no real reason to take his guns away, and no one wants to take his guns away. But why do people react that way?
Well, because if you ban AR-style rifles, you're taking people's guns away.
If you ban them, do you have to turn the guns in, or the ones that are already out there are going to stay out there? I think that's kind of, isn't
that? Well, Yeah. I mean, that's the issue. So, I mean, if you simply ban a certain weapon and
And we've done
grandfather
that
all the weapons
before
in,
under Clinton administration, right?
yeah. And it really under, I mean, if you really think that that's a problem, it's going to undermine the effectiveness because there's millions and millions of AR style rifles out there already, and there's many workarounds that people can do. And you also then just leave, millions and millions of semi-automatic pistols with, large capacity magazines. And so that then once you, the ARs are gone and the mass shootings haven't stopped, then you have to go to the pistols. And,
Well, I
so I
mean,
think that's,
we'll see what happens when we get there. But is it unfair? You tell me, David. Is this unfair to say that the people who want to have their AR-15s and Bushmasters and all those other things, and they see the mass shootings as that's just a trade-off that we have in America to have the freedom to have those guns?
I think that they would say that people who have evil intentions will find a way to act out their evil intentions and to criminalize a law-abiding person's behaviors or possessions to try to keep someone who is a criminal from doing what they want isn't fair to them. And what if I know we're running low on time, but the other thing that I would say is that if we want to build some consensus, one of the things that we shouldn't talk about is common sense reform. Because what you're saying, if you use that term, which is a political term, it's not a descriptive or an analytical term, is that if you disagree with me, then you don't have common sense. And that's going to be a non-starter
I
in
think what
terms
we're
of
talking
these
about, though, is
discussions.
that we've done polling. We've found areas where 70% of the country agrees on certain items, but we can't get that legislation to the floor because the chokehold that certain organizations like the NRA have on the political system.
Yeah, so I mean, you say widely agreed upon,
Yeah, polling.
yeah, but I'm saying like, common sense is a political term. It's rhetorical and it's divisive.
Well, so you're a
So
sociologist. What's a better way to talk about this?
I'd say, I mean, we could say widely agreed upon, something like that, because honestly, then someone can say, well, I must be in the minority on that. Is different than saying, well, if you don't agree with me, you don't even have common sense.
Right.
That's dismissive.
Great. And you're right. And having the right words to talk about these things that don't alienate people is a positive step forward. And Al Kaufman, I give you the last chance here.
Well, I think in terms of the legislation that has been passed, Maryland passed a bill controlling the sale and of AR-15s and registration of AR-15s and increasing registration. AR-15s are light guns, but they never wanted to do it retroactively. They always said in the future it would control it. So there was never an effort there to say that we ought to send the police out to every home to take out all their guns. On the other hand, and I will say this, I'm sure it's going to get some hackles up. If someone has been declared mentally ill and has been found to have committed spousal violence, such as the shooter in Sulphur Springs, then there should be some control so someone could go
Well, they
out
don't,
and take
then they
those guns
cannot get
away.
a gun legally. They will not pass the 4473 ATF form. I want to thank all of our guests. I want to thank Al Kaufman, professor at St. Mary's School of Law, David Yamani, sociology professor at Wake Forest University. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.